about to hear was originally recorded for the TrackSec podcast. You can find out more about the TrackSec podcast at www.tracksec.com. Well, guys, I'm blessed to announce today's TrackSec guest is the man himself, Mr. Moxie Marlon Spike. Hi, Moxie. Welcome to the show. Could you introduce yourself to the audience, please, buddy?
Hey, Aaron. My name is Moxie Marlon Spike. I'm a fellow at the Institute for Disruptive Studies, and I'm happy to be here.
As I say, I mean, it's always a pleasure to speak to you, Moxie. I spoke to you over at Hacker Public Radio before, it's nice of you to come on. I suppose I'm going to do the usual sort of question that you ask on a security podcast to security people, but how did you get into the whole hacking scene?
Through the 90s hacker scene. At least in the United States, during the 90s, there was this, kind of thing that was happening where, hackers weren't, there's no money in security, right? And so there's a lot more community in terms of hacker culture and people working together and sharing information because it wasn't really worth much and it was just, sort of fun and interesting for everybody involved. I became really interested in stuff through that and, working with those folks.
Yeah, I mean, for people that do know about you, you've released some pretty damn exciting software over at thoughtcrime.org, such as SSL Strip, for starters. I don't suppose I could get you to maybe give us a short description of what that tool is and where you would deploy it and how it sort of works.
Right. So SSL Strip is like, it's basically trying to attack the bridge between HTTP and HTTPS. The idea is that, SSL on the web is kind of strange because it is, in a way, dependent on this insecure protocol for delivery, right? Like, connections don't often start directly as SSL connections. They're upgraded from HTTP connections. And that upgrade happens when you, click on a link that says checkout or shopping cart or login. And that the user interfaces of modern web browsers is really designed to provide negative feedback. It's designed to warn you when things are going amiss with your SSL connection, with the certificates that you're seeing. And SSL Strip is trying to exploit that by preventing that SSL connection from ever occurring and avoiding the negative feedback. So you don't get some of the same positive feedback, but the idea is that it's really the negative feedback that people are looking for. So basically, just attack that bridge by downgrading the connection and preventing it from ever becoming SSL. And it's a simple trick, but it's actually pretty deadly in practice. And
carry on. Buddy. Go ahead. Sorry, I must admit. I mean, I've used the tool myself, and it's pretty awesome. I mean, you hear a lot of people saying that it's about, user awareness, but I doubt very much that most average users, even most security people, would really notice that much that the site's having the SSL stripped out of it. What were you about to say anyway, Moxie, before I so rudely interrupted you?
No. I mean, you're right. It is pretty effective. I've done experiments where I run it at security conferences, right, before a talk, and, even so-called security professionals who are supposed to be, very aware of these things and the threats and know that they're on a hostile network, they're at a computer security conference, even then I have extremely high success rates intercepting credentials. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty deadly. In fairness, you're quite well known for your attacks on SSL TLS, like the basic constraints attack and the null prefix attack. I know that they're very different, but could I get you to explain to the listeners at home, firstly, what exactly the basic constraints vulnerability was, and then maybe if I could get you to later on maybe talk to us a little bit about the null prefix attack, because I absolutely love that attack, by the way. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, okay. Well, so the basic constraint stuff was, an old vulnerability where, certificates are, often come in pairs, And sometimes they can come in chains, where you have like a chain of trust. A root certificate authority will sign an intermediate certificate, which will then sign your end entity certificate for your website, like the crown.org. And what I discovered is that the most SSL implementations weren't verifying the chain of trust correctly. So there's a field called basic constraints on a certificate that is supposed to tell you what a certificate is good for. Not all certificates should be able to do all things. And the basic constraints field should limit a certificate to being able to, sign other certificates or not. And what I found was that, first of all, most certificate authorities didn't issue certificates with that field set. It was just missing. And that even if it was there, most SSL implementations would ignore it. So if you got any certificate for any legitimate domain, if you went to .crime.org and you get a certificate for .crime.org, that certificate that you got was essentially a CA certificate, because you could then use that to sign any other certificate that you just invented and pass to a web browser or other SSL implementation, and it would accept it as valid. So I started talking about that because, or I've been talking about that, or just bringing it up recently, because that was the vulnerability that originally motivated me to write SSL Sniff, which I've been updating for more recent attacks.
Yeah, I was going to say it just leads so nicely onto the SSL Sniff tool. I talked about it recently at the Aberdeen University in Dundee, and it was So basically, with your valid certificate, you're basically, am I right in thinking that on the fly you're able to sign basically certificates for different domains and sniff traffic quite effectively then?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like when you're exploiting the basic constraints vulnerability, if you had any valid certificate for any domain, some domain that you legitimately own, then on the fly you could intercept connections for any other domain, generate a certificate for that domain, sign it with your certificate, pass it back to the client, and they would accept it as valid.
And one question that I'd love to ask you about this as well. Was this primarily IE, or was this across the board that the basic constraints was happening?
It was pretty across the board. The most, I'm not even sure if I remember now. I mean, at the time, this is like the early 2000s or whatever. At the time, the Microsoft Crypto API was the really big game in town, and so just like these recent vulnerabilities, it affected the entire Microsoft Crypto API, which means that any software that runs on Windows usually uses the Crypto API as its SSL stack. So, just as recently, the null prefix attacks affected the Microsoft Crypto API. So that in turn made not just Internet Explorer, but also Chrome, Safari, and all the other stuff that runs on Windows vulnerable.
And then that just moves us swiftly on to the null prefix attack. Can I maybe get you to I know you're probably bored to the back teeth of talking about the null prefix attack, but maybe for those at home who haven't come across it before, could I get you to kind of do as a kind of quick introduction to the basic concept?
Right. So the basic concept is basically that the strings that are embedded in certificates are encoded using AFN1 as the protocol format. And so when you're parsing apart a certificate, the strings inside of it are essentially Pascal strings, which means that it's like a tag length value system where you have like a 1-byte tag that says this is a string that describes some property. Then you have a length that says, the string is going to be 5 characters long, and then you have the actual string value, 1 byte per character. And the major, consequence of this is that it's different than how C strings are represented in memory, right? C strings, you don't know how long it is. You just get a pointer to the first character, and you have to keep iterating through memory until you encounter a null character, and then you're at the end of the string. But when you look at Pascal strings, which is how certificates encode string values, A null character has no special meaning. It's just another character in your character string. And so the idea was that what you could do is generate a certificate for a domain like www.paypal.com null character.buttcrown.org. And when I submit this to a certificate authority, they will sign it because I own the domain buttcrown.org. But then when I pass it to a web browser, they will pull the string out and evaluate it as a C string using a compare against what it's trying to connect to. And the null character in the string will terminate the compare and it will validate successfully. So essentially what you can do is get certificate signed for any domain that you'd like. And then it, you know, you could take the concept even further and generate wildcard certificates, you know, like star null character.buttcrown.org, get that signed, and for some SSL implementations, notably all the Mozilla products, that would match any domain. So you could just get one certificate signed that would match everything. And so, yeah, so that's the basic idea.
Yeah, and for anyone that's interested in that listening at home, if you go to ThoughtCrime and ThoughtCrime.org, you'll be able to find Moxie's white papers on it. They're very interesting, I must admit. And I've done a couple of talks at our local Linux user group and done some stuff for podcasting. It's a really interesting attack, I have to be honest with you. I also love how you defeated OCSP, but that's a different story for a different day, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I got this question sent to me from a friend of mine the minute that they heard that you were coming on the show. And it's really a two-folded question. I have to ask you, really, what were your thoughts on the TLS renegotiation vulnerability, and what are they now? Because obviously, as times evolved around that vulnerability, the how it can be attacked seems to have changed slightly.
It's an interesting vulnerability. I personally have not found it to be extremely useful in practice. You know, it's very similar to cross-site request forgery, and you know, you get a little bit more maybe out of it, but it's you know, websites in general should already, you know, be designed to, you know, resist cross-site request forgery. And you know, a lot that you could do with the renegotiation stuff, you could just do with inserting an image tag into someone's HTTP stream. So there have been a few cases where I thought, you know, it could be interesting to try and do something with this here. But in general, it's a really, really specific attack where you need a very specific set of circumstances, and the stars sort of have to align to make it really useful in practice.
Yeah, I've not had any joy with it yet, I have to be honest with you. I mean, I'd read that some people had some joy using the using it with SSL strip to basically downgrade an established SSL connection down to
yeah,
to a, and do it then. Because am I right in thinking that SSL strip can't strip an already established SSL connection? But I was reading that basically the potential for the renegotiation vulnerability to basically downgrade the connection, so then you can start using SSL strip. Have you had any joy making that work?
I haven't tried. So the problem with that is that it's not a generalizable attack, right? You need to know ahead of time what your target is going to be looking at and figure out some URL or request to that site from an SSL session that will downgrade you back to HTTP and then plug that into SSL strip. And so again, it's this really very targeted thing where you have to like sort of know a lot of the variables ahead of time. And I think in general, my preference tends to be with the network attack tools that I just want to run it and get everything on a network. You know, that I less often find myself in situations where I sort of know everything ahead of time about what's going to happen, and can, you know, set up all of the circumstances and variables to exploit that. So, you know, I think, you know, there are some like edge cases like that with the renegotiation stuff where, yeah, you can do some cool things with the downgrade stuff, you can do some cool things with in a few other places, but it's again, you know, it's just really it's pretty specific.
Yeah, it does for me. It does seem that it's not a usual one fight, you know, one size fits all. But it does seem that there might be potential to leverage it if you know very specific. Maybe it's good for internal penetration testing. Do you know what I mean? I'm quite sure if you know which internal site you want to attack, then I suppose it's good for that.
Yeah, no,
Well,
perhaps.
anyone that's visited your sites knows that, like you say, you have some pretty awesome projects. And the last time I'd spoken to you, we had a you know a chat about some of them. But I'd noticed that you've got a couple of new projects up that I was really tempted to talk to you about. One of them being Google Share. Could I get you for the folks at home to kind of sum up what it is and what it can be used for?
Right. Okay. So Google sharing is like it's a targeted anonymizing service, and you know, the idea is that, I mean, increasingly now there's this consensus that what Google is doing is getting a little bit dangerous, that they have a lot of information on a lot of people, and the privacy implications of using Google are a little bit questionable. So what we've done with Google Sharing is set up an anonymizing proxy, and we've also written a Firefox add-on. And the Firefox add-on runs in your browser and watches your outgoing requests. And whenever it sees a request for a Google service that does not require a login, so things like Google Search, Google Images, Google Products, Google Maps, but not things like Gmail or Google Checkout, then it will redirect that request via SSL through the Google Sharing proxy. And what the proxy does is maintain a pool of basically identities that are shared amongst all of the users of the proxy. So the pool is basically a set of cookies that are issued fresh from Google and user agent strings and other HTTP headers. And those identities are passed between the requests that get proxied through the Google Sharing proxy. So the net result is that all of the traffic looking, all the traffic coming from the Google Sharing proxy appears to Google as if it's just a large corporate NAT. You have one IP address with a number of, you know, legitimate-looking clients behind it, but each one of those clients can't really be pegged to any individual user since all of the requests are shared among clients. You know, so basically, you get some anonymity and are still capable of using Google services without having to visit any special websites or anything. It's just totally transparent, and it's you know, it's different than just full-on anonymizing systems because it's targeted just for Google search requests and, you know, other Google services. So very fast. It doesn't affect your normal web browsing usage patterns, right? Like if you download a large file or something, it's not going through Google Sharing. You're using your direct internet connection, but just to these the Google that you'd like to be anonymized are.
Okay.
So that's the basic system.
I mean, I suppose this is a really stupid question to ask, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. How do you think Google see Google sharing then? Do you think they're pretty freaked about it or?
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's I don't know what they think. You know, right now there's about 30,000 users, and it's, you know, continuing to grow, but that's, you know, less than a drop in a bucket from their perspective. I think the potential that it has is as we continue development on Google Sharing, it's looking like it's moving more towards a distributed model that could eventually become something meaning a peer-to-peer model.
Okay.
And when that happens, then it's interesting because there would be no way for Google to know whether data it's collecting from any given IP address is authentic or not. And so that's interesting, right? Because at that point, you can sort of imagine that you're in a significant way destroying their ability to collect information on people, even if they're not using Google sharing, which I think is a kind of interesting concept.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it lays foundations as well for, I'd imagine, for other search engines that may come up in the future, you know, collecting huge amounts of data. Obviously, there's not many search engines in the same league as Google, but I suppose there's a lot of lessons to be learned here, and it sounds a pretty awesome project. Completely left field of what we've been talking about here. I noticed the other day as well, I noticed a wee while ago, but I had to put it in here. I'd really like to talk to you about your WPA Cracker site as well.
Yeah,
I mean, it looks awesome. Obviously, same question again for the folks at home. Could you sum up what WPA Cracker is?
Right. It's a site where you can upload a network capture of from a WPA network. So you collect WPA handshake using, you know, any of the aircraft tools or anything like that. And then you can upload it to the site, and we will perform a dictionary attack on the handshake. But we use a large cluster of CPUs to do the attack. So whereas you know, we have a few different dictionary options, and even the smallest dictionary option that we have would take 5 days to run on a, you know, temporary fast desktop machine. But we can run it in 20 minutes. So, you know, the idea is basically you can get these dictionary attacks done very quickly by using our service. And we're starting to expand into other formats as well, and we'll like it to become just sort of a general cloud cracking service. Where we can support, you know, all different types of formats. You can upload whatever you'd like and, you know, very quickly get cracking results, either brute force or dictionary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's an awesome project, I have to be honest with you, and it seems, you know, fairly priced, a fair price for the service. It seems it seems a really interesting project.
Could I just jump in here?
No.
It's usually the other way around. Aaron interrupts me, but this time, really, it's sorry to interrupt your flow here, Aaron. But really, question really for Moxie. You know, looking at WPA Cracker with a reporter's hat on, as it were, it looks like, you know, Mox is a real black hat here. You know, you can upload anything to him and he'll just crack it for you. I noticed that the FAQ mentions this is how you can recover your passwords. I'm guessing that's carefully phrased, but do not think you're making yourself a really high target here. I mean, I understand, you know, otherwise I'm really asking yourself here.
Yeah. I'm actually not so sure that it's that clear, right? The people I know that use this kind of thing are actually network auditors and penetration testers. That there's like an interesting contradiction, right? Where when you're doing WPA cracking, you need a network connection to be able to upload your handshake to our server. So situations where someone's just like trying to get on their neighbor's wireless because they don't have internet access, or they're somewhere and there's a WPA network that they don't have internet access and they would like to get on, you can't really use our service because in those situations you would need an internet connection to begin with in order to, you know, upload the stuff. So it seems to be more often used by people who are, you know, actually doing penetration testing. They have a network connection of their own and they'd like to evaluate the security of whatever network they're auditing. You know, that said, anyone can use it for any purpose, but that's sort of the contradiction in all network security tools. Yeah.
Okay. Just thought I'd ask there. Go on, carry on, Aaron.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, before you carry on, Aaron, from a penetration testing point of view, I mean, I know personally when I do penetration testing stuff, quite a lot of the time it's in the contracts that we're not allowed to give this kind of information out to external companies.
Right.
So, I mean, although, I mean, I really like the idea of being able to have a distributed cracking network that can do the work that would take us weeks to do in minutes, but it does purely come down to contractual sometimes, where it simply says that this information has to be kept within house and you can't send it out to external parties. And I know that's come up before, but I think HD Moore was actually looking at doing a similar thing with Metasploit, doing kind of cracking in the background. I know that never came to fruition. Has that ever become an issue for you? Have you ever heard of people saying they'd love to use your service, but they can't because of contractual
issues? Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's definitely come up. And there's some stuff that we're working on at Metric. For instance, as we support other formats, it's harder to do with WPA and, you know, actually probably impossible, but with other formats, you can do some interesting stuff where you can blind the content. For instance, we're about to add PDF support where you can crack encrypted PDFs through WPA cracker. And you can, what we've done is written a tool that allows you to extract basically the metadata needed to do the cracking without leaking any of the contents. And then you can send us just the metadata and you know, we can perform the job that way without ever having access to whatever content it is that you're worried about leaking. And you know, so basically we can try and do some things like that as well as a few other tricks to perhaps, like, you know, help with that problem.
Sort of back on the shoulders of that question, Moxie, would it be fair to say that maybe the relationship that you're having with people with WPA Cracker is actually, rather than third-party testers, actually system admins of the organization wanting to test their own WPA key rather than third-party penetration testers saying to their clients, can we, obviously because of contract problems and so on and so forth, is it fair at the moment then to say that maybe you're working pretty much with the actual physical owners of the technology?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, at the end of the day, I know very little about the clients in general. You know, it's, all I know are the sort of people I know that use it. And there have also been cases that I know of where penetration testers have been able to, you know, talk to whoever they're doing the auditing for and say, listen, you know, this is a service that you should allow us to use.
It's going to save everyone money.
Yeah, exactly. It's saving money, and the truth is that, like, if you audit their wireless network and we crack their password, they should change their password, you know, or deploy something else, right? So it's not that much information isn't really leaking. So, you know, a lot of times they can get questions.
Jumping back to kind of earlier talk, earlier questions, recently I'm seeming to hear a lot of people telling me that you know, SSL isn't long left for this world. I mean, what do you think the answer is? Do you think that we build a replacement, or do we kind of try and patch SSL for modern requirements? I mean, I'd really like to get your thoughts on the state of SSL and what needs to be done.
Yeah, okay. Well, so it's interesting. I think there are a few lessons that can be learned from the stuff that's happened recently with SSL. I mean, first of all, if you look at SSL as a protocol, it is terrible. You know, it is, you know, second to Kerberos, kind of the perfect roadmap of mistakes that people have made in designing future protocols. So you can look at the evolution of SSL and realize that, you know, all of the things that we have learned about how to design a secure protocol are, you know, sort of mapped out through the mistakes that are embedded within the protocol. So at the protocol level, yeah, it doesn't look great. You know, that said, people have managed to sort of, you know, tack things on and do implementation-based workarounds and all this stuff to compensate for a lot of the real protocol-level problems. A lot of the attacks that we've seen recently are implementation errors. And, you know, they're sometimes interesting in that they're, you know, implementation bugs that every implementation makes, which, you know, is kind of a unique situation. But, you know, I think if you look at sort of the history, like if you look at just the history of the attacks on SSL that I published, there is not an SSL implementation that has ever existed in the history of SSL implementations that has been secure. But if you look at, you know, starting from like the last attack that I published, you know, back through time, you know, all the attacks sort of overlap to cover every SSL implementation. And I don't think that we should assume that it is any different now, that, you know, at this point, there's an SSL implementation that is somehow secure. But I don't, you know, to me that says less about SSL than it does just software and, you know, the inability to write secure software. So I think, you know, just, you know, one thing that we need to come to terms with and that, you know, people have been coming to terms with for some time now is that secure software is just kind of impossible, that it is not really reasonable to think that we're going to be able to get all the bugs or that we're ever going to be able to make something, you know, as complex as an SSL stack completely secure.
So do you think we're in a situation where we're kind of using SSL as a crutch, basically saying our application is insecure by design, but as we've got SSL, we're fine?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but this is something that you see all the time, right? I mean, you need to, you know, one of the first questions that any auditor should ask is, you know, what happens when you're compromised? Not if you're compromised, right? But, you know, to think that any one piece of technology is going to provide sort of absolute security for your entire system is kind of dangerous, right? Because, you know, security software in itself is always vulnerable. You know, there are vulnerabilities that exist in intrusion detection systems. You know, just like anything, you want to layer defenses, you want to try and isolate data and areas of your network. And so when you see stuff like, you know, for instance, the Mozilla auto update protocol, which was depending on SSL for security against all possible attacks, these are dangerous situations to be in because, you know, I think we've seen and will continue to see that it is unreasonable to think that that one piece is ever going to be absolutely secure. So, you know, if you're using SSL but not signing your updates, that's probably a problem.
So as long as people are using defense in depth, using SSL along with your hashing of passwords, using SALT, challenge responses on logons, and you know, doing things like using MAX to prevent people from changing data when it's in transit, then they should be as secure as they can be. If they're just using SSL, what you're trying to say is that they're already onto a loser.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. The deal is that, you know, no one piece is ever going to really work, but you know, maybe if you combine them all together, you'll get something that overlaps in a way that you know, gives you, you know, the security you need. But even then, it's a difficult game.
Moxie, the last of my questions. I know that the lads have got a couple more for you, but I'm going to ask you the fluffy question, but you know, what's your advice to people that are wanting to get into the hacking scene? You know, people wanting to get involved now. You know, what would your advice be to a fresh face wanting to get involved?
I would say start with the basics. You know, read TCP/IP Illustrated. You know, volumes 1, 2, and 3. Read, you know, Applied Cryptography. Read, you know, the design and implementation of computer hardware. Like, you know, if you really, ultimately, security is really just about, you know, understanding how all the pieces fit together and then finding the holes in the glue. And so, you know, starting with the basics is the best place to begin.
Brilliant. Tom, do you have questions? Tom, are you there, mate?
Yeah, I'm here, yeah.
What's, you had some questions for Moxie, didn't you?
Yeah, I've got a couple, actually. The first one, I didn't actually put this on the correspondence before, but it's just come up now. Obviously, we've been talking about SSL and, like, the no prefix attack before and stuff, but how did you actually get into, like, working on that? Like, what was it that drew you to actually doing that work in the first place?
I guess, you know, I've just been interested in secure protocols and SSL for a long time, and... you know, I think it's you know, attacking something like SSL is often interesting just because it's so foundational in a lot of ways that, you know, if you find one bug, you've really probably hit a lot of pieces of software because there's only a few stacks and, you know, so many different pieces of software then link to those stacks. So it's an interesting place to look for stuff. And, you know, I'm just interested in secure protocols in general. So, you know, finding those little holes in the glue is, I don't know, just kind of fun for me.
And when you did find the vulnerability in what you found, recently I found a hole in WordPress and I got some media attention. Some was good and some was bad. And I mean, what I'm trying to ask is, did you get any bad media attention from breaking this? And like, how did you go about dealing? And how did you react with that?
No, I wouldn't say that I got any real like bad media attention. You know, it seems like, you know, reporters, you know, particularly in this sort of trade press these days are, you know, hip to the idea that, you know, security research isn't bad. You know, certainly in, like, the comments of some articles that I saw written, there were people that were like, this guy should be locked up in jail, you know, whatever. And, you know, then the sort of, you know, negative feedback that I got was from people like PayPal, right, who responded, you know, not openly, but sort of more surreptitiously. And, you know, that's a whole saga of its own.
I think, Chris, are you there, mate? I heard someone drop off.
Come back to limbo.
He's back to limbo. Robert, do you have any questions for Moxie?
No, well, yeah, actually, and this is a bit of a rotten one to drop on you, Moxie, but some of these SSL issues, if you like, would you see IPv6 perhaps mitigating some of those? My apologies if you don't, if you or IPsec, I should say, rather than IPv6, mitigating those in any way? Or is it one of your fields?
IPv6?
IPsec, well, obviously that is linked with IPv6, but IPsec itself, the lower level encryption.
Right, yeah. I mean, yeah, like IPsec is all right. It's definitely some lessons were learned in the design of IPsec.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to have proved very difficult to deploy, and
it certainly has difficulty
like a lot of situations
with getting the certificates between sites. But yes, yeah, carry on.
Yeah, and I mean, even if you look at, you know, for instance, like it seems to me that like VPN software was, you know, where IPsec really ended up being sort of deployed. And strangely, if you look at, you know, where that stuff is going, it's all moving towards SSL VPNs. Everyone is abandoning IPsec for their VPN solution and deploying SSL VPNs instead, which, you know, is interesting and confusing and all that stuff, but it seems to, like, come down to just ease of deployment and, you know, the way that the implementations work on software.
Yeah.
You know, so, like...
So my apologies. It's the yeah. Time delay, I reckon. I think it's hard to know when someone's sort of stopped. But.
Right.
You had
no, go ahead. What were you saying?
Sorry, I was going to say it's another case of ease of use trumping possibly better security in effect.
Yeah, but it's also it's a little bit more than that. I mean, there's one thing that's like ease of use, and then there's another thing of just like, is it usable at all? You know, that there's... You know, some people can't VPN into their, like, corporate networks because, you know, the VPN client, like, segfaults the Linux kernel and stuff like that. You know, there's some really bad implementations out there that it's not even just a matter of deploying them, but it's just, like, they don't even work at all. And so, you know, that's problematic.
Yeah, yeah. I had one other question, really, which was... I was looking at this is not related to the SSL thing. Well, it sort of touches it gently, I suppose. I was looking at your knock-knock tool, the port-knocking tool. I thought that was an interesting approach, that instead of going down the let's build a knock-knock server and slap it on all the ports and have a yet another tool which could be subject to vulnerabilities, that in fact you've tried to make it as small and simple as possible. Perhaps you could describe, I know Aaron's asked you to describe all of your tools, but I think this one's quite an easy description really for people. You know, perhaps you could describe that. I'm sure they've heard of port knocking tools.
Sure.
How yours differs in some way.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, the basic port knocking concept, you know, makes a lot of sense. You want to expose as little code to strangers as possible. And, you know, there's a lot of times there's no reason that anyone should be able to connect to, you know, your SSH daemon. There's no reason that anyone should be able to connect to your IMAP daemon. You know, this is software that I guarantee you right now has remote vulnerabilities in it. So you want to, you know, partition that off as best you can. And, you know, the initial port knocking concept made a lot of sense, and people looked at it and thought, well, isn't this really just security through obscurity? You know, how many different port combinations are there and all this stuff? And so the problems that emerged really suggested the use of something like cryptography to do this sort of authentication. And people just lost their minds. I mean, people went crazy with this. I mean, they started embedding their port knocking stuff into the kernel and, like, writing kernel modules. People started writing whole services that exchanged UDP packets and, you know, did RC4 and all this cryptography and stuff. Like some things, it's like a, you know, a five-way handshake to open a port. And, you know, to me, it, you know, it seems like, yes, there were some problems that needed to be addressed with the original port knocking concept, but the idea behind all of this is that you want to reduce complexity, you know, that you want to simplify and reduce the code path that you're exposing to people. And when you start using, like, you know, libbcap to inspect every packet on the network, or, you know, write whole other network services or embed stuff into the kernel, that's sort of the opposite of the direction you want to be headed with this. And so Knock Knock is an attempt to kind of remedy that by having, like, a super simple, very easy to audit port knocking implementation that doesn't use libbcap. It doesn't run in the kernel. It doesn't use any crazy libraries, and it has a, you know, contemporary NCCA secure protocol where a single packet is sent to open a port. And so, I'm pretty happy with it, and I think it's pretty easy to deploy and to use.
Yeah, I've looked at other, you know, SSH knocking and port knocking stuff before, and like you, I suppose, looked at it in despair and thought, you know, I'm only wanting to secure this. You know, I don't really want an entire course in all these wonderful servers that you've set up. So yeah, looking at it, it's nice and simple. Create a certificate for the server client pair and distribute them. Yeah,
maybe it's to turn a phrase of yours, Bob. It's, you know, users are after 2 AA batteries and we give them nuclear power solutions.
Yeah. Well, this one's a one granny solution, or what I would call a one granny, or I would call this a one sysadmin solution. You know, it's a, you haven't got too much to get your head around, and if you've got 700 things to do that day, this is one that you can go, right, I need that and that. Create these certificates, distribute it, I'm done, I can move on to the next job, and feel reasonably confident about it for the same reasons that Moxie is pointing out there, that it's simple. You can look at the Python code, you know, it's not massively complicated, and, you know, I think it's the way to go. And as again, if you are talking about libpcap for these other things, if there's a compromise in libpcap and it's looking at every single packet that's going by, then, you know, let loose the dogs of war on your network, really. Whereas with this, then perhaps you might allow someone to attempt to get into your SSH at worst, or at worst, all your ports are blocked. So, you know, I think it's an interesting tool.
Chris, was that your last question for Moxie, by the way, Roman?
It's a question come making my own point, so I'll just be quiet now.
Wouldn't be the first time that's happened.
I was going to say, that makes a change, isn't it?
Now, pot, kettle, black.
Chris, we had this beautiful link from Moxie talking about eBay, not eBay, PayPal, and you dropped off the call. I know you had some questions for Moxie, so, you know, jumping back.
Yeah. I wanted to cover the PayPal stuff because I've not been a big fan of PayPal for the last year or so. I don't know how much you talked about it when I dropped off, but I know that they PayPal circled around and weren't particularly happy about some of the stuff you were teaching in your course, which quite luckily links in with my second question, which is about your upcoming courses. I mean, is the stuff with PayPal still ongoing? Or is that now resolved?
Oh, yeah. They still have my money. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a very interesting situation, right, where you think that, like, one of the most important qualities of a payment processor or, you know, something that is essentially masquerading as a bank is trust, right? You know, that if at any time, you know, this third party you know, steals, like, their customer's money or just takes it or whatever you want to call it, you'd think that that would sort of be the end of them, you know, that word would get around and everyone would stop using them. But they do this all the time. You know, they just, you know, confiscate people's money, and people continue to use them because they've really sort of dominated this market in a way where it's almost impossible not to. So yeah, it's a really bad situation, and you know, there's basically nothing I can do. You know, I have no recourse to get my money back, and they've just decided that you know, they, you know, didn't like the things that I was doing, and so, you know, now they've retaliated by taking my money.
To jump in here, it's probably fair to ask you if you could maybe recap for people that don't know the story about what exactly happened with PayPal and null prefix certificates, and just kind of your views on that, because, like I say, some people at home might not have actually heard the story. I'd be surprised if they haven't, but, you know, better cover the fences here.
Right. I mean, I guess, like, the basic outline was, you know, so in my talks, I often use PayPal as an example of, like, a site that you might want to intercept communication for. And, you know, I do that because it's an obvious example, and, you know, it's inflammatory, right, that people realize that if their PayPal credentials are compromised, that could be dangerous. And so, you know, they don't like that. I mean, they, you know, someone from PayPal sent me an email about that after I, you know, gave the talk. And so things were kind of unsteady, and then someone published a null prefix certificate for PayPal to the full disclosure, I think, mailing list. You know, they freaked out and responded by suspending my account, which is, you know, kind of funny. Then, you know, the saga has kind of continued with Google sharing, where they suspended my PayPal account, and I was able to get the EFF to kind of negotiate with them, and PayPal said, okay, it's fine if, you know, we'll sort of back off, but the deal is that you can't use PayPal for anything associated with thoughtcrime.org, because, you know, whatever, they're taking a stand against thoughtcrime. So I haven't been, but then I was using PayPal to accept donations for Google sharing. And they, you know, a lot of people very generously donated to Google Sharing, and then PayPal suspended that account and has held onto that money for months now, and isn't working with me to resolve, you know, to help me get my money back, essentially. So it's kind of a, you know, complicated ongoing saga here, but
Do you think that maybe it's a problem of, I hate to say this, but a term almost like a lack of regulation of PayPal, that there isn't an ombudsman, there isn't an overseer of the giant that is PayPal, and that there is
a bank in all but name, that's what they are.
Mm. But there's no way for you to...
But there isn't, because they like to occupy that furry space in between, because if they were a bank with a capital B, if you like, they would be regulated. But they do handle, in effect, they're handling money. It's just made to not look like money. They're a broker, really, aren't they? They sit between a seller and a buyer, so they're a broker. But they are, in effect, a bank.
Yeah, but, you know, they're not classified as a bank, and so they're not regulated in those ways. And
Moxie's not unique, as pointed out. You know,
as he's pointed out, he's not unique. Sorry, Moxie, I didn't mean to interrupt you. As I said, the time zone, the delay difference here, I think, is causing the problem. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, because I mean,
yeah, I mean, exactly. There's plenty of people who have problems with PayPal, you know. People's money is taken and suspended all the time.
Well, they did it with Hackers for Charity as well, didn't they? There was some kind of mistake in their paperwork, so they suspended all their accounts and left Johnny Long stranded in the middle of nowhere with no access to any of his money. But obviously, the bad press surrounding a charity being cut off by PayPal forced them to actually get things back up and running again. So, I mean, although there's people there who support you and who are going to complain and who are going to say, well, I'm not going to use PayPal because of what's happened here, there's not quite so much outcry as there is with Hackers for Charity, for example.
Sure. And the other problem is that there's nothing else. They don't really have any, like, serious competitors in that exact market of what they're doing. And so it's kind of hard to just say, well, I'm going to stop using PayPal because, they are sort of, like, filling this market that people care about, and
a monopoly, they're a monopoly at the end of the day. There's no two ways about it. You're absolutely right. If you want to take donations now, you're going to have to think of very alternative mechanisms for dealing with it, because not only is it the case of you receiving money, but also how do most people making a donation are going to have a PayPal account. You're now going to have to ask them to add in another layer of abstraction.
Interesting as a business is we don't deal with, if someone only says you can only pay us by PayPal, we contact them to find out how else we can do it, not because of any particular views on PayPal, but just that as a business we don't want to go down that route. You know, we have checks, we have direct debits, we can pay in all sorts of ways, and it's just incredibly awkward for us to pay through PayPal. And where I've tried to make donations to some open source projects, which I have done, it's always turned out to be awkward because the only method of payment, or that they perceive as payment, is PayPal. It has become awkward. You know, in the end I've had to usually do something like find out maybe what web servers they're using and offer to pay for that service for them as a donation. You know, it isn't ideal for businesses.
Yeah.
For simple end users, my apologies for that, but you know what, for Harry homeowner, I think, yeah, that's fine, or for small open source project, but it does make it awkward as a business to deal with people and to even donate in some ways. So it isn't all PayPal's way, if you know what I mean, but...
Yeah,
maybe the answer is maybe creating something like PayPal and then arguing that PayPal have a monopoly on it and that it isn't fair.
Possibly having an open source clearinghouse would be the other way, maybe, you know, because there's a lot of projects I'd like to donate just, you know, 25 quid to. I use every day as a business, and I think, well, really I should be donating to this because, you know, it's a vital part of what I do. But if I go to the website and the only way I can pay is by PayPal and there's no other way, then I'm sorry, lads, you know, I'm not going to donate. I'm not going to donate directly because there's no mechanism by which I could do it. If there were perhaps a central, a bit like you have, ignoring all the other SourceForge issues, but a bit like you have SourceForge for hosting your project, if there were a similar way that you could have a central donation place that business could come to get an invoice from you and deal with you in a business-to-business-like way, and then they dealt with distributing it. A bit like the model they use for, and again, this is going to upset people, perhaps the model they use for collecting royalties for music, you know, that sort of thing.
Burn them.
No, I do, you know, as a business, I'd love to donate more. I'm not the only one.
No,
I'm sure out there, you know, not all businessmen are, you know, you shouldn't always get an image of a grey being circling you and about to devour you, because we aren't all like that, honest gov. But yeah, you know, something like that would be better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to turn this into a PayPal thing, but I mean, I know what you mentioned about them being the only one available. It is and it isn't true. They're the only ones available that aren't based in Russia and used to... So, yeah, I mean, there are options out there, but none that we would like to be using.
No. No. And Honest Bob's open source exchange isn't quite up and running yet, but when it is, I'll let you know.
Work on it. Let us know, and we'll move Moxie over.
Moxie, I mean, obviously another question for you there is how are you actually handling, are you getting donations now, and have you found another mechanism that maybe doesn't mirror PayPal, but achieve some of your objectives, or are you just high and dry?
I'm pretty high and dry. I switched to this thing called Tipit2, tipit.to, and you could, you know, it's like this tip jar system or whatever. It seems all right. And just after I switched, they, like, shut down. because I guess...
they were, the Moxie kiss of death.
Like, a fraud problem or something, you know? Like, there are too many, like, I don't know, something was happening, and they basically shut stuff down to try and implement, like, better abuse heuristics. But the funny thing is, like, you know, I switched, and I was like, hey, I switched to this. And, you know, people generously made some donations, and, like... You know, the threshold for which you can cash out is something like $100, and you know I have like $98 in there or something. And the you know they've shut down, so I can't get any more donations in there. So I'm like you know $2 below the threshold of what I can cash out. So that money is just sort of gone too, right? Because there's you know it's bad.
That's really unfortunate. Really really bad luck. Well, I mean, hopefully I know you're doing quite a lot of training at the conferences now, so hopefully that's bringing a more direct flow of cash to keep your projects running. I mean, do you want to talk briefly about the training you're doing? Because I know quite a lot of people have been talking very highly of it.
Oh, good. Yeah, I've been doing a training called Designing Secure Protocols and Intercepting Secure Communication. And the deal is it's a two-day training, and the first day is all about designing secure protocols. It's about... you know, how you combine these cryptographic building blocks into something that is secure. And we go through all of that and then use that knowledge to look at, you know, sort of existing secure protocols and evaluate how they stack up and attack some kind of mock protocols and stuff. And, you know, everything from SSL to SSH to encrypted web cookies, you know, you have a better idea of how to look at it and evaluate whether something is or is not secure. And then the second day is all about tricks. It's about, you know, attacking the little holes in the glue between secure protocols and really, you know, sort of practical hands-on using tools to perform network attacks and that kind of stuff. And, yeah, it's been pretty good, and I think it's a fun training.
And is that U.S.-based?
Well, let's see. I'm doing an upcoming training at Black Hat Europe in, I guess, that's April. And, yeah, maybe at a few other conferences in the future as well.
I understand you're going to be doing it at BrewCon as well, is that right?
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure how that's shaping up, but if, there's some possibility that I will do it at BrewCon should enough people sign up and the training fills up.
You have four of us signed up already, by the way.
All right.
So we're not paying for it through PayPal, okay? Yeah, we're going to have to give you cash on delivery or something.
Yeah,
Chris, have you got any more questions for Moxie? Well, I take that by the dead silence that he must have dropped off.
No, I'm just about here. I mean, the last thing I wanted to ask about was a comment you made on your Twitter feed. I know you were at RSA conference in San Francisco, and you mentioned that your name was up in lights on one of the vendor walls as the Moxie SSL stripping and network attacks.
Is that something
you're seeing more often now?
Is it what?
Is it something I'm seeing more often?
Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't even there. That was, like, a friend of mine sent me that picture. It was just, I don't know. It was pretty funny, right? But, I can't remember what the wording was. It was like defeating the Moxie attack or something like that. It was just some random, you know, vendor booth or whatever. But yeah, I don't often see my name like on billboards or whatever.
What I thought was interesting was that underneath it just says DNS hacks. So it doesn't say the Kaminsky attack. It just says the Moxie attack. So obviously you've reached that threshold now where you've knocked the man off the list.
Oh, Moxie, if you need an agent, Chris is your man, obviously, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, it could be that, like, if they mentioned Kaminsky, like, they would have to pay some kind of royalty or something where they know that I'm never, you know, I don't have it together enough to sue them or whatever for trademark something.
Never know when PayPal give you cash back, you never know.
That'd be great, though, wouldn't it? The T-Mac attack.
That just sounds like a computer game, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Rainbow Six T-Mac attack.
Is there any more questions from the hosts for Moxie?
No, none from me. None from me.
No, Chris, I'm good.
Well, what's left for me to do is basically in wrapping up. Firstly, Moxie, absolute pleasure to have you on the show. I've really, really enjoyed speaking to you again.
Yeah, it was great.
You can find you at www.thoughtcrime.org. I believe you're on Twitter this time now. Last time we spoke to you, you weren't on Twitter. If I'm right, that's @Moxie__ or something like that.
Yes, regrettably. I'm there.
Is there anything you want to say to the folks at home before we wrap up the interview?
No. Just thank you guys for having me on, and yeah, it was great talking to you guys. And hope you
we love having guys like you on. It's a lot of fun. do feel free to join us to stay on the line. We're going to talk about some new stuff, and we've got a tech segment sort of inspired by some of your tools as well. But all that's left for me to do is thank Moxie, and we'll be moving on to the news section.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.